Sorry, not the usual disclaimer today.
Yeah, we're ready to go.
You're going.
All right.
Sorry about that.
Hey, we had radio silence.
My headphones didn't have any sound.
Yeah. I didn't get my usual cue.
Terribly sorry.
So the
music played and all that good stuff.
We the people radio online. Yeah, here we go.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ryan.
Hi, my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape will get you pretty much anything you need when it comes to John Deere products. Full parts and service. They do it all. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard up in the city of Shasta Lake, right in between the Pine Grove and Oasis exits, just two doors down from Phil's Propeller. But go up and see them and get your John Deere needs or even any other brand. I think they work on pretty much any brand of tractor you've got. They'll take care of you. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There.
So
what do we got going today, Aaron?
Okay. Well, Bill, actually what we have going is we have some really nice people who sponsor the show besides Pape Machinery.
Yes.
Not that we do not love them. Mike, can you say that? That's like 17 negatives in a row. Anyway, we love the Pape Machinery, folks. But thank you so much to all the individuals who fire off sponsorship to the show. So this week's acknowledgement goes to Ellen. Thanks, Ellen, for sponsoring We the People so we can bring you fun information. And, you know, for people who potentially haven't been really following or don't follow every week, I really, really would encourage you to go back to August 6th, 2023, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children with our guest Paul Skinner. He is going to come on and speak with us about specifically on the topic of exploitation of children and then on missing children. So we're going to do two different shows. He is working on finding children at the moment, said he was going to be busy on cases for a few weeks, but he's going to come back on and talk to us some more about that. So for those of you that have keyed into Sound of Freedom and are wondering if anybody's doing anything about any of this, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children does an excellent job. They partner with all of our law enforcement agencies around the country, full of really interesting professionals who do all sorts of different things and lend a hand free of charge to our law enforcement folks in the things that they need.
And we got some good feedback on that show, too. A lot of people listened to it and liked it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there are things that you don't see that much, but it's funny. It's kind of like, I think, if you buy a red car, all of a sudden you notice how many red cars there are. We were watching a show the other night. It was about some person that was missing, and they kept flashing up the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children logo.
Yeah.
And I guess I've seen it before, but didn't really know what it was. So, anyway, I hope you will take a listen to that. So, today is August 20th, and we are speaking with Nathan Deshmaker, minerals, coal, and energy. But his article is All Roads Lead to Rome. And I thought, that's a fun title. So we've posted that for you, so you can go and actually read his article. He and his family raise registered feeder calves in central Montana. He's a senior research associate and policy analyst specializing in federal and local government administrative procedures, land and natural resource policy making, local government regulations, and program management. And he doesn't work for the government, P.S. Nathan is also an accomplished musician and a self-taught theologian with a love for the classics. That's probably why he's so smart, you know? It's the classics, right? The stuff that comes out now, not so great. He has worked with local governments to identify and challenge attacks on small farm and ranch operations facing increased pressure and regulation by forces and groups outside of Montana and many times outside the U.S. And tell you what, anybody who deals with agriculture or folks who are in agriculture knows that the pressure is unbelievable right now.
Oh, they're grabbing land like crazy.
I'm just not sure where people think they're going to get their food.
Yeah.
That is the overwhelming question. So, Nathan, do you know where we're going to get our food? Is that what we're you're going to answer that burning question for us today?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that we can maybe touch on that a little bit. That's a pretty good question on where food will come from when you know, I think we have case examples historically. You can see communists. The state or government has never been successful farmers.
No.
Communist systems show that pretty clearly. So we need to protect and preserve liberty of the individual and private property and access and utilization of resources for the betterment of mankind and particularly our nation of people who are covenanted together on those principles of liberty. So that's what I've been talking about more is, you know, not just the issues of where our food's going to be coming from, but how did we as a people get so removed from the foundational principles that our founders so adamantly relied on?
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned in your article was any place the government has basically restricted the use of private property and people's rights, those societies have inherently failed. And I think
it makes sense. I mean,
yeah.
Who cares for the land the best? The people who own it or the people who just sit around in an office and talk about it all day? You know, I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer. Who takes care of your house better? You know, you or the city that you live in that makes all the rules that you have to follow? It's always the people. They always do a much better job.
Yeah, I would agree. It's fundamental. And I was having a discussion with somebody here the other day on the fundamental need for active citizen involvement in government in our country. The problem is government in our country has become so bureaucratic that the process is so convoluted with, as you were just saying, I'll use what I call swivel chair experts. that's where the rulemaking is coming from, is those realms. And so that's maybe one of the things we can touch on is the stuff that's been on my desk is in relationship to Montana, but also has impacts across the West. Two things. One is our coal is under attack in some significant ways. And then the other side of that is we can hear maybe is there's a lot of things moving to push for renewable development. And now there's currently regulatory rewrites of right-of-way rules for access to our public lands. And for energy development to take place on public lands, there's right-of-way fees and acreage fees. You know, you don't just go and file for a lease to develop oil and gas or a wind farm. There's fees that are involved with those things. So what's happening right now, BLM is rewriting the regulations to reduce the acreage fees and the capacity fees for wind and solar, while at the same time they're bringing forward regulations to increase those costs for the oil and gas sector. So those are some pretty big issues of picking winners and losers in the energy environment and the access of lands for generating electricity. And we know that wind and solar is really not super effective. It's not putting out the capacity of energy that it's that the nameplates, when they put in a wind farm, it's supposed to reach a certain amount of gigawatt electricity and power generation. And from data out of the European Union, they're only reaching like combined average of like 18% of the capacity rate for what they've put in for generation.
That's what they've sold is these great outputs, but in actuality, it's 18%.
Well, that was out of a study in the European Union from 2011 to 2021 of laying out the actual percentage that they reached of what their the nameplate capacity was. That study also did a cost-benefit comparison of how much overspend there is compared to if they just were using conventional energy sources like natural gas. And the overspend in the long term was like $1.8 trillion, and then the capital overspend over gas firing systems was over $600 billion. So it's massively subsidized. It's not, you know, and one of the questions I asked in a recent paper somewhere I put out there was, so the Nature Conservancy and Princeton and, you know, the Cloud 10 organization or whatever it's called, they all put out a white paper saying that we need as much lands as Wyoming and Colorado combined for wind and solar development to reach 2050 net zero objectives. But so here's a question. Are they basing that on the nameplate capacity of wind and solar, which they're only reaching like 20% of that nameplate capacity? And if that's the case, that just shows we're going to need a heck of a lot more land than Wyoming and Colorado for wind and solar development to meet those generation targets. Right. And so it's just appalling they're even pushing in that direction based on those realities.
Well, yeah. And then you have, what do you do with all the blades from the wind things? They've got to bury those because there's nowhere to put them and no way to recycle them. And all the things that go into it for what we get out of it. I don't remember if I said anything about it last week, but I was looking at vehicles, and there was one of these, you know, hybrid deals, which would not be my deal. But it is a plugging in hybrid. And so I don't know. I just got randomly curious. I wonder how much you get on the plugging in part, you know. So I started reading down into the details. Yeah, you can leave your car plugged in like a toaster in your garage all night, and you can get 25 miles out of that before you switch to gas.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? And it was, you know, so much more expensive than the regular version of the vehicle. And I thought, that's just a feel-good thing.
Yeah, how's that ever going to pencil out? I mean, you spend all that extra on a hybrid.
25
then,
miles?
Yeah. Take forever to pay for it. So on the flip side of subsidizing all this wind and solar and you know, trying to grab all this land to implement it, they're on the other side, they're cutting back on coal, hydro, you know, all these,
taking out the dams.
Yeah, taking out dams, and these are all systems that are much cheaper to produce energy and much more efficient and much more dependable, but they're going to try to do away with all that. I just don't see how that's
how that's ever going to happen by 2050. Space, right? Like, there's a huge use of, you know, like what you're seeing in Montana. They want to use our open space for that. Is that kind of where they're headed with this?
Well, I think there's, you know, Montana, they're pushing the wind and solar development across multiple states, in particular the West. So when it comes to the public lands, federal lands out there, they're rewriting things and reducing. So the problem they're facing is private investment, private enterprise aren't, even with the subsidies in some cases, making capital investments for wind and solar development on public lands. One of the justifications BLM claims for promulgating this rule to reduce the acreage rates and the fee rates is to incentivize more private capital investment. So that tells me that Bureau of Land Management, Department of Interior, rightfully so, are anticipating significant wind and solar development shortfalls in capital investment. So instead of them stepping back and being like, okay, the private market and enterprise aren't investing fast enough, maybe there's not returns here that justify the investment. And that's the problem with this rule and these other rules they're promulgating with all this. where's the cost-benefit impacts analysis in relationship to the impacts both on the environment? One, they're going to need massive amount of lands for the transition. And two, for the socioeconomic impacts by, because like you said, they're also trying to shut down access and leasability of our coal estate in Montana and other places across the West, oil and gas development. So where's that cost-benefit analysis? And then the answer is there really hasn't been one officially through the federal departments that are implementing these executive actions. And I say executive because most of these goals and objectives, the net zero 2050, 30 by 30 objectives, transitioning the grid to carbon neutral sources by 2035, none of that's been delegated to executive departments via congressional law. So it's all executive orders that set those targets and objectives. But what's happening, the way those, most people know those things are out there, but we have bureaucracy, federal departments and agencies that are implementing that through rulemaking. And here's one example of where they're doing that is lessening the fee rates to give an unfair advantage to wind and solar development. And like I said, at the same time, they're increasing the like-kind fee rates for oil and gas. So it's
so they're
not allowing the market to work.
Right, right, right. And another way of picking the winners and the losers. We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, let's pick up on that thread that we should play a couple songs about fools because it just seemed like a good theme. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Change, change, change.
Hi, this is James Brown, soul brother number one, always fighting. Now I'm fighting for your life. I'm fighting for your life because if you use drugs, you better leave it alone. Drugs are contagious. They're killers. Every drug is a killer. Stay away from drugs. Drugs will take your life away. And if you want to live, stay away from drugs because they are super bad, super bad, super bad, super bad. Super bad.
The human race was dying out. No one left to scream and shout. People walking on the moon. Smog will get you pretty soon. Everyone was hanging out, hanging up and hanging down, hanging in and holding fast. Hope our little world will last.
Yes, hope our little world will last. So, Go back, Nathan, to the picking of the winners and losers using basically using regulatory authority and fee structure.
Yeah, so what I'll do actually, I'm going to actually touch on what you mentioned earlier about the reclamation of these things when they go out, and then we can shift over to
okay,
the economic
yeah.
side a little bit. I just wanted to
you
touch
drive
on
the bus.
That, though,
I'm sorry. I'll get back in the back. I don't drive the bus. What was I doing? I lost my mind.
No,
I grabbed for the wheel
you're good.
And I was wrong.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to capture this because otherwise we'll move forward and I'll forget to bring it up. So
okay.
I just wanted to bring it forward anyways. So you mentioned wind, the solar or the windmills, you know, what do they do with them? They just pile them in a dump somewhere or whatever. So the justification from Department of Interior or BLM on the oil and gas leasing rule, which is increasing costs, They state the onshore program, and that is for oil and gas leasing and development, historically has failed to provide the federal government with a fair return, exposed the federal government to significant reclamation-related liabilities, lacked adequate cost recovery mechanisms, and encouraged speculative leasing and wasteful development practices. So that's what they state on the Federal Register regarding oil and gas. But every single criteria they list of their of the concerns with oil and gas, not bringing in a return on the investment, having significant reclamation-related liabilities, and no recovery mechanisms, and a speculative leasing and wasteful development practices, every single one of those criteria, if you take that and apply it to wind and solar development, it is significantly multiplied, because oil and gas, for instance, provides about a thousand times as much gigawatt generation per unit of land as wind and solar. So, and that's something that's called power density, which is an actual equation of how much energy generation you get per unit of land. So they're concerned about oil and gas not having reclamation related liability or having those issues, like I said, are amplified significantly on the wind and solar, because they're going to be taking up a whole bunch more land when they expire. Think about the costs. I mean, we're pumping trillions of dollars into this through the Inflation Reduction Act and other Build Back Better Act and all this subsidies spending. But there's no provisions in that spending of accounting for the downstream costs of having to dismantle those 20, 25, 30 years. Or if you're a solar farm that got hailed out a year from now, to reclaim those things in an economically, you know, beneficial manner. And so those are the types of things. They're really not, it's not only picking winners and losers in the fee rates and in the economic aspect, but on the impacts analysis side of it as well. They're blaming oil and gas for a criteria set of impacts that are significantly amplified under wind and solar development scenarios, but they're not even looking at that in their wind and solar rules.
Yeah, it's kind of a one-sided analysis at that point. They recognize one, but they don't want to bring up the other.
Let's not bring up the unpleasantness, right? That makes it also creates just a lot of fighting. You know, you just have a lot of argument with all this stuff, and so people point to the way that the government chooses these, thinking that means that's the best choice. I mean, that's the default position is, well, it must be good if that's what they're using, which is obviously not accurate.
Exactly. And, you know, back to markets and private investment, our constitutional republic and the system of government our founders established was very much in the context of understanding, as I mentioned earlier, private property. But that also, it, by extension, acknowledges private property in the means of production. And even federal statutes to this day, the Mineral Leasing Act, the Minerals and Mining Policy Act, Federal Land Policy Management Act, many statutes in place in relationship to our mineral estate and those important industries prioritizes the facilitation of private industry or private enterprise investment and development of those resources. So our laws, like the minerals laws, for instance, directs government to facilitate an environment that allows private investment in those industries. And that doesn't mean subsidizing them, but giving access and investment access for capital investment in those industries to the private individual and private enterprise. So those things, not only are they embedded constitutionally in our republic, but it's really in a lot of our laws. And what we have now is that, as we all know, a way out of control administration that thinks even though we have a couple hundred years of failed experiments of central economic planning, that now they think they can do it in a way that actually benefits the people and the individual person. And that's the test they now have. And I think I would submit they're already failing that test because we have increased costs, we have inflation, some big issues on that front.
Oh yeah, just when you look at the mandates, then we mandate everything. So it isn't even like we're going to find out if it's a good idea. We're going to first make rules about it, force everyone to do it, and then in the meantime, there are some real world consequences. You have some auto manufacturers that are taking huge hits because they've been incentivized to make all these electric vehicles, but they're not selling necessarily as many as they need to sell because people have figured out. I realize most of them go more than 25 miles on a charge, but you know, when they figure out that's what happens, and you have to pay for the electricity. It doesn't just come out of the air.
Well, aside from the fact that, you know, fuel prices have gone through the roof as far as gasoline and diesel, people are struggling to afford that, and some reason they think the flip side's going to be, let's go out and buy an electric vehicle for $60,000. They can't afford the gas. How are they going to afford a $60,000 EV? I mean, that just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. Not only if they can afford it, but even if they could afford it, of whether or not that's their preferred purchase.
Yeah, right.
That's the other side of this is, and I'm glad you bring it up, the car deal, because that's another good example of forcing manufacturing development that's not driven by free markets and the consent of the demand of the consumer.
Right. And now the consumers are...
That's not good.
No, and consumers are weighing in. I read an article last week. I'd like to tell you where I read it. I'll search for it. I'm posting one. Peter Huntsman wrote a great article about climate change and kind of the way he looks at that from a business standpoint. He had some really, really solid points in that article. And but I had read a thing from a guy who lived in Canada, bought an electric truck, and took his family. They were going to go to Chicago or something. And it was like stopping, charging. Oh, wait. Stopping. Got to stop again. Got to charge. Oh, wait. The charging station's broken. Uh-oh. We can only go another, I don't know. He was down to the wire. Went to the next charging station. That was broken. And he's like, he was into this truck deep. I forget what he said. Like 70,000, 80,000 bucks. It was a lot of money. He's like, now I'm stuck with this truck. And I can't even go on a trip with my family because you can't get there from here.
Well, there was an article just a couple days ago about a Ford executive that took a cross-country trip in their new Ford EV just to kind of test it out. And
maybe that's the same one.
That could be.
Did he get hung up all the time?
Well, yeah. His words were the trip was somewhat challenging because of the lack of charging stations, the lack of being able to travel more than just a few hundred miles before you had to have a charge, and then the wait times because they didn't have quick chargers. They had to use regular chargers. It took hours to run a charge, and as a result, they're teaming up with Tesla now to develop quick chargers for their vehicles because they don't have the technology to really make those trucks feasible and marketable. People are looking at it and going, gosh, I don't want to have those problems. I travel and, you know, I don't want to have to, you know, drive a couple hundred miles and then have to sit and wait for 45 minutes to 2-3 hours to charge. So there's some real problems with that technology, and I think the manufacturers are now starting to recognize that. And I'm not sure where do they go from here.
Those are good points. Then there's some car companies, I believe Toyota was one of them, that never did really jump down, that rightfully anticipated, you might get a lot of money up front to push this investment, but now the ones who took that quote-unquote free money, and now you have cars sitting on the lot and this and that. And back to the articles you guys are mentioning, you know, I don't, the people behind the electric car movement are really, it's more about, they don't want commuting and significant travel and the freedom or to relocate. And I think that's logically the reason they're pushing the EVs is because even with a significant investment of infrastructure, if we had no alternative than electric vehicles and no more gas vehicles, which were a long ways out from that, honestly, it could never be done in a way that maintains the market order and the traveling context that we have the capacity to today. Not just traveling, but extraction of raw resources, including the agricultural industry, because I'm not out here in an EV tractor driving around plowing the ground. Not going to happen.
Well,
so electric vehicles are like a glorified bicycle, pretty much.
Yeah, and if you live in a rural area like you, you're not in this big city where you're only driving a few miles every day. You have to drive long distances, and if you were to go to a completely electric vehicle society, you're cutting out huge swaths of the population for their ability to move around. I just don't see where that's going to fly.
Well, that article from Peter Huntsman, I just posted it. So if people would like to read it, that's on the page for today.
Well, one of the points he makes in that article that I thought was very telling was, you know, they talk about the carbon output of the United States and how many metric tons it is. Well, he was saying that back in the 1970s when they measured carbon output in industry, it's pretty much the same as it is today, which is fine, but the actual production of products has gone up 10 times what it was in the 70s with the same amount of carbon output. And nobody talks about that. All they talk about is we have to reduce it. But we have made major strides in creating technologies that produce a lot more for a lot less.
Agreed. And, you know, it's back to that power density. And I read the other day in a piece that actually come from the other camp that's pushing for all this, but acknowledge the fact, and this is a pretty profound thing to think about. 50 gallons of oil, 50-gallon drum of oil, in energy equivalence is around 4.5 years of a single person's labor. No horses, no anything, just you. You know, I hauled 12 bales of, 1,300-pound bales on a flatbed trailer yesterday, hauled mini loads, but one load, 30, 40 miles down the road, and I was driving with my wife and my girls, and I was like, it would take me 2 years.
Yeah.
to take this load 30 miles down the road to my brother's place without oil and gas. So when you think about it in energy equivalence,
yes,
in that context, how do you think they built the infrastructure in the ancient world? Slavery, human servitude, and a whole bunch of horses, mules, and whatever else you could get for raw labor to build those types of infrastructure. And so that's a problem, is we don't want to revert back, especially with the increased population in the world we have compared to the ancient world. I mean, we're at billions of people.
Right.
And that's what some of the scientists are making the point of pushing away from nitrogen fertilizer as well. Is you do away with nitrogen fertilizer tomorrow, within a short time frame, a couple years, half the world population no longer exists, because right. half of the world, for their basic substance of food, depends on nitrogen fertilizer.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Oops.
Where's the cost-benefit analysis there?
Apparently we haven't taken that into consideration. Well, that's the thing. You look at all these little microcosms. I always go back. I'll find it and find the date. But when we interviewed Dr. Patrick Moore from Greenpeace, he was telling us that he got out of Greenpeace when they wanted to ban chlorine. You know, they just came up with some crazy idea. Let's ban chlorine. He's like, you can't ban chlorine. It's an element on the periodic table. So sometimes the people that are coming up with these ideas aren't necessarily the, okay, they're just not the sharpest tools in the shed. Let's just throw it down. it won't be the last mean thing I say. So anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with our guest, Nathan Dashmaker.
I can't do everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. We'll sing it.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. In a recent court case, Freed v. Garland, it was determined both medical and recreational marijuana users have no right to firearms because marijuana use was associated with elevated risky decision-making. It is beyond dispute that marijuana users experience altered mental states that affect their judgment, creating irrational and unpredictable behavior. There is a clear relationship between the bevy of recent active shooters and marijuana use. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Playing in the places where they're coming up with the policy.
I got news for you.
Music.
We're a long way from Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
What?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, stop it, Bill. Just, you hater.
I know it. We're not there yet.
So I did find the quote from Peter Huntsman. So he says, "Think about the year 1970. That's the year we hit $1 trillion GDP, and the year Jimmy Page and Robert Plant wrote the great song Stairway to Heaven. A great year, right? Well, today we're emitting roughly 6,500 metric." Tons of CO2. The same thing we were emitting in 1970. And look at how much more electricity we're using. And look at how many more transportation and miles we're driving. We've expanded the economy 30 times over, nearly, and the core CO2 has stayed flat. We should be celebrating that achievement.
Yeah, we don't want to mention that.
Huh. I guess I haven't heard that anywhere. Apparently that's not being widely publicized. But it kind of goes to your point, Nathan.
Yeah, that's a good quote, and very, very true. Because we are very. Meanwhile, we're shipping our coal over to China and Japan to burn, which Japan's pretty efficient. China probably not so much so in their coal burning facilities, which they're building a lot of them. Well, they're not going net zero.
No time soon.
By 2050. So yeah, that's a good quote in that context of not only why is that not, so we haven't increased emissions and we've had significant increase of economic output, but another thing to take into consideration there is the U.S., even with the gigatons of electricity, or not electricity, CO2 emissions that are emitted, is still a really small percentage of the global scene in certain contexts. And also the human contribution of CO2 into the atmosphere in comparison. One of the things I ask people when this discussion starts with CO2 and emissions and carbon and blah, 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 is how much of the greenhouse effect is CO2, and how much of that is from natural processes, and what are the natural contributors without leaving humans out? Most people can't answer that. But the answer is oceans, all plant vegetation in the fall that dies and decays emits gigatons of CO2 into the atmosphere. There's charts out there that you can look at that have been put together that show the comparison. First of all, the greenhouse effect only makes up, like, I don't know, 2% of the atmosphere to begin with. 95% of that is water vapor. Then there's some other gases, and then like 3% or something of that 5% is CO2. And a huge percentage of that CO2 is
of the atmosphere, for heaven's sakes, or lower.
Exactly.
And then you look at...
super minuscule.
It's super small, and you look at, besides that, and I really wonder if Leighton Stewart's still around. Is he still around? Do you know him at all? He's a super nice guy.
I don't.
He came on years ago, and he kept talking about how CO2 makes plants grow. You know, I mean, that was his bottom line. It's like, well, no kidding. We all learned that in sixth grade. So... CO2 is actually not a bad thing, not a pollutant, and here we are destroying the developed world to guard against something that isn't harming us when we have a volcano that happens under the ocean.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to mention that.
Yeah, you got the volcano under the ocean that everybody kind of forgot. Well, actually, they didn't forget. They weren't told about it. And that put out more than, I don't know, civilization for a bazillion years or something.
Yeah, the water vapor that went into the atmosphere on that volcano, they said, will affect our weather for probably the next 5 to 10 years.
So not a bazillion? I was wrong.
Probably not a bazillion, but it was it was a lot of water vapor, and it was seen from space, the amount of water that went up into the atmosphere. But they didn't, the media didn't mention that, because that's kind of contrary to what they want everybody to believe, and it's not going to really add to their debate of global warming and what's causing it, because what you just said, I mean, there's a lot of natural things out there that are contributing, and that volcano alone was huge, and nobody mentions it. Nobody says anything about it.
Exactly. Well, there's a lot of that going on. The problem with central planning is most of them are not willing to admit to their mistakes, and that's true in the sciences as well. So
I'm shocked.
Yeah. So volcanoes, yeah, is a big one. Like I said, the water vapor. And don't say that too loud. They'll start coming after water vapor too. Well, now it's water vapor.
Taxes on our water vapor.
So I've actually submitted. I'm of the persuasion that the reason carbon is the target is because our economy is a carbon-based economy. It's actually the hub from which all economic transactions come in and out of, because carbon is virtually everything materially we deal with, and the base load of energy that gives us the capacity to transport and get those products out into the market. So this is about economics. And I think we need a renaissance in the policy arena and administrative process back to fundamental economic principles, because we have Keynesian economics and way out there economists And now we have even this modern monetary theory, which is just print and spend, and there is no consequence because we can just keep printing.
Right. That's working out well.
Those are huge, huge systemic issues with that economic process. And I mentioned this kind of a little bit earlier, but that's one thing that pre-existed the constitutions of Western civilization is the market. We didn't create the market with the Constitution. We created the Constitution to safeguard the market. The freedom of the individual and private property and the market mechanisms of contracting.
Well, they were able to grow out of
mutually in society.
That. Yeah, we were able to develop those things because we prioritized innovation and the product of individual labor. You know, I mean, you look at societies that operate on a collective system, and China is a great example. So on a collective system, you're not allowed to innovate because you're not supposed to be thinking for yourself. You're supposed to be doing what you're told. So when you tell all your people to do what they're told, and they actually, you know, over centuries are trained to do that, they don't innovate. They copy well, but they don't innovate. And that's part of their problem. That's why they steal all our stuff, because they don't have innovators. But in a free society, you have lots of innovation. And it's interesting because Huntsman brings that up too. He said, you know, why are we not letting the market run? Because we will, our congressman here talks about that too, that if we let the market work, the innovation that people would come up with, which got us to this point, will also solve the problems in the future.
And that can't be planned.
Right.
That's the thing about...
You will innovate. Do it.
The free market is... There's so many independent levels of action of individual people functioning unilaterally from one another. There's a complexity to it, but in a free market context, you can't plan it. And as economists have made the point also, you also can't, once the free market spontaneous mechanisms are established and the order is there, you can't perpetuate it with planning either. And that's what they're trying to do now is use the market frameworks. They're borrowing from the free market context to try to put, because otherwise they're just reaching in the dark or placing value on something. Because
right.
Value is also something that's determined through those mutual contracts and relationships and the willing to buy, to purchase, and to sell. That's agreed upon on mutual contractual terms between individuals functioning on the market. Government can't even function without that framework to have a framework of understanding value and economic value to certain products and certain services. And so the market is absolutely essential, and that leads me to a point that Nicolay, I may be saying his name wrong, Tangen, who is the chief executive of the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, he predicted that the Biden administration's obsession with greening the economy will mean that high inflation is a permanent fixture for the foreseeable future. He said, quote, companies benefiting from economically ineffective and inefficient projects through applying for green subsidies has fundamentally flipped free market principles on their head, an arrangement that is sure to invite economic chaos.
Wow, end I quote. Love him. He's my new hero. After you.
Well, he makes a very good economic point there.
Yes.
That... And so back to this solar, what we were discussing earlier with solar and wind and picking winners and losers and driving generation shifts on our grid towards these ineffective and inefficient projects and driving dollars that way. So another work I've been reading that corresponds with this is Murray Rothbard's book, on the power in the market, man, economy, and state. And in there he says, transfer spending or subsidies distort the market by coercively penalizing the efficient for the benefit of the inefficient. Subsidies prolong the life of inefficient firms and prevent the flexibility of the market from fully satisfying consumer wants. The greater the extent of government subsidy, the more the market is prevented from working, the more resources are frozen in inefficient ways, and the lower will be the standard of living of everyone. Furthermore, the more government intervenes and subsidizes, the more caste conflict will be created in society for individuals and groups who will benefit only at one another's expense. End quote.
Gosh, I think...
So there's another good one.
I think somebody wrote a book about that. I think her name was Ayn Rand, and I believe it was called Atlas Shrugged. that's like if you're going to put a synopsis of Atlas... If you want to see how it turns out, just read Atlas Shrugged. Because that is exactly what happens in her story that she wrote back in the 1950s, obviously, by channeling the future somehow, and looking at, hey, what happens if we let bureaucracy run the world, we stopped using common sense, and we crushed all the producers? You know, what does that mean for regular people? And what that means is the end of freedom and innovation and happiness as we know it, truly. Bad news.
And that's always been the battle.
That is always the battle. It never, and it's never going to stop. We will always have to push back on that as citizens in a free market. We will always have to defend it. Nathan is our guest next hour. We have him as a hostage for another hour. And you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Oh, how much fun is that? Here's a little song about compliance, just in case you were into it. You might not be into it.
We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore, no more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore, no more self-reliance.
Good afternoon. Hey, that's how it was supposed to be last time. Instead of when I got tangled in my own rope. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is, one of our many sponsors this hour is Pape Machinery.
The one you get to talk about, you mean?
That's right.
Your favorite one.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. And they are our premier John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And if you need a mower or a tractor or implement, if it's green, go up and talk to them because they can get it for you if they don't have it in the yard. So they got good inventories right now and full parts and service. You buy something there, they're going to fix it if something goes wrong. They also work on other brands. You can talk to them about that. And their phone number, if you'd like to give them a call, is 530-226-9226. And you can also get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da! So, you are listening to We the People. You can always find us at wethepeopleradio.us. You were going to say it, weren't you?
No, I was going to.
You were going to
turn it loose, see if you remembered how.
I know. I remember how. Huh. And there's all sorts of good information in there on how to sponsor the show, if you've got ideas for shows. You know, there are a lot of people out there, I'm finding, who are experts in what they do. They don't get enough airtime. And if there's an interview, I was talking to a guy who does a show up out of Susanville, and we were having this conversation that it's super frustrating to hear people interviewed for just a few minutes at a time because you don't wind up learning anything. So we try to do the rest of the story, kind of like Paul Harvey used to do way back when. but let people talk about their issues. So we've had enough shows on marijuana, China, environmentalism, national security, veterans, South Africa, and Islam to actually fill categories on the website. So you can always go on there if you want to see a specific category. You can follow the shows on there. But we have 13 years of archives, free to listen. Robert, who sits in with us a lot, he takes all the free market breaks out of it, so you don't have to do that. You can hit a show in about an hour and 40 minutes, separated by the first hour, the second hour, easy to download. You can do whatever you want with it, and we hope you make use of it because we do the show to provide information to the public. And again, if you've got ideas for people, call us, email us. Our information's right there on the site at wethepeopleradio.us. And there was something else I was going to say. Oh, my free advertisement of the week, Nicolet Glass here in Reading. You know what? If you still have really blazing hot sun shining through your windows, you should get those screens that block out 90% of the UV. We put them on our kitchen. Oh, my God. The kitchen's like 10 degrees cooler every morning. Yeah. Spectacular.
Yeah.
They got out there, did the quote. We called, do the screens. They were back on in, like, I don't know, 2 weeks. And in the meantime, the nice guy who came to install the screens helped me flip the glass on our table, the giant piece of glass, so I could clean the bottom half. They are super helpful and super nice and a really good value. So there you have it. Back to you, Nathan. where should we go this hour? What did we not talk about that you had on your list? I'm sure you had a terribly long list, and we just fiddle-diddled around and got you all, you know, sideways on it. But what, with your article, you want to go into some more of that?
Well, I could, just for information purposes, I could touch maybe really quick on some of the coal details in Montana.
Yeah, we love information purposes.
Yeah, the right-of-way rule and these things, these are all things that are happening currently and in process. So on the coal front, we have the Powder River Basin, which is situated in Wyoming and Montana. And that basin contains up north of 80% of the subsurface coal estate that is administered by Bureau of Land Management in the nation. So that's not private coal. That's all federal administered mineral estate. So a huge amount of that federal estate is in the Powder River Basin from a federal government perspective. And currently 40% of all production nationally is coming out of the Powder River Basin, including all coal production. So the court has forced rewrites of environmental impact statements for the Miles City Field Office and the Montana side, which is calling for the two preferred alternatives that they had out for comment on the draft impact statement. Right now, the available acreage for lease of that coal is 1.2 million acres. The two preferred alternatives, one reduced it to 52,000 acres, the other to zero. So that's a 95% decrease of leasable subsurface coal estate in the Powder River Basin and in the Miles City Field Office from what was just approved in 2019 in a final record decision.
Wow.
So
this massive what prompted this huge change?
Well, so all the RMPs across the West, 2015, went through an amendment process for the sage-grouse stuff. And that was what prompted this, because out of that, there was provisions brought in a couple groups, and I think the Sierra Club was one of the groups that was a litigator on that. So it was a sue the agency approach. So under the Trump administration, they did a full impact statement and analyzed alternatives and issued the final decision that was finalized in 2019. And those same list of litigants sued again, and somehow were successful through an activist judge here in Montana to force them to open up the whole process again. And what they did this last go-round, and this is of deep concern to our conversations about carbon thus far. What it essentially did is they forced the BLM to take into consideration greenhouse gas emissions as a proxy for climate change. That's not my language. That's the language in the court order, and that was developed as an analysis by Bureau of Land Management for that region. So they're using these totally new impacts analysis is being directed by the court, not the Congress, to analyze downstream greenhouse gas emissions as a proxy for climate change, and they're using that as a justification to reduce the leasable amount of coal in the basin. And likely this is going to be challenged at some level if they actually, because this is in draft right now, they got comments on the rule, but the two preferred preliminary alternatives push for huge reductions of leasable coal estate in eastern Montana. And they left out 9 counties which have current leasable coal that's currently leasable under the existing framework out of the socioeconomic impacts analysis in their documents. So there's some problems there.
What? Okay, so for people who don't deal with this kind of stuff, why would they have done that? What is your speculation? How about that?
Well, it's similar to what they're focusing impacts analysis on the greenhouse gas emission side of things, but not doing due diligence on the economic impacts analysis side of things. So because there's no mining taking place in those counties currently, they didn't do a thorough impacts analysis or even included in the so they only included the socioeconomic region where the existing mines are. But this rule isn't about existing mines, it's about leasable coal estate. So in other words, those 9 counties that have a substantial amount of coal within their counties have potentials of private enterprise to invest and develop those resources, which generates significant amount of revenue for the private sector and as well as the state and local counties, the way the tax structure is that fund those local governments and those rural communities. So if they remove the leasability of that coal, they're removing any potential of real economic development on the mineral estate in those counties. And So my view is they didn't do a socioeconomic impacts analysis of that because they don't want to look at what those numbers actually are.
Yeah, they don't want people to...
How convenient.
People to know that information.
It's like that's like how dogs logic things out, you know. If they look the other way, you can't see them. So if they don't look, it's
catch me
not hurting anyone. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyways, that's kind of the nitty gritty of the rule. Bottom line is, though, for your listening audience is, and the reason this is important is because this is a Montana region, but it has impacts that are nationwide because it's a huge amount of the subsurface coal estate that's administered by the Bureau of Land Management in the country. So tying up the capacity of leasing those lands or that mineral estate for productive purposes back to the shift to this renewable energy push is it's not just they're shifting the renewable energy, they're forcing a generation shift away from our carbon-based sources to these unreliable, unsustainable, cost ineffective systems that have never really been proved for their purposes.
Now, is this reversible? I mean, the way they're going about this, can it be reversed either legislatively or I know a lot of things they do is by executive order, and that's all temporary. But can this be reversed?
So So that's a very good thing you bring up there. And the answer is, so right now this is not a final rule yet. This is still in process. This is just what the agency is proposing for alternatives to shut off that leasability. So they're going to come out with a final impact statement. I just submitted comment on this. I believe the state did. Other entities, counties submitted comment on this. So they're going to review those comments. They're going to change the impact statement accordingly, or if they necessary. And then they're going to issue a final draft with a decision. And then it goes through a 60-day comment period, 30-day protest, and there's also a 60-day consistency review with this governor's office. So this is all in process. So it's not final yet. So it's reversible in the context that it's not done yet. We have opportunity, and I've equipped the record on this front. And like I said, other entities have. And the state's very interested in this, too, because a lot of that coal estate through those nine counties is checkerboarded with state trust lands. And checkerboard means there's a section that's federal, and then right kitty corner there's a section that's state land, and it's like that across the large region. So if the BLM shuts off the leasable coal estate on the federal lands, they're indirectly shutting off the capability of leasing the state coal estate.
Right.
Because most, in those checkerboard contexts, the state and federal government have to work together for the feasible context of mining the coal. So there's another 1.5 million acres of state land, roughly, mineral estate, that would indirectly be tied up in this decision as well.
So bottom line is that all that property is owned by taxpayers, supposed to be for the benefit of taxpayers, being cared for by either the federal government or the state government for the benefit of taxpayers.
Right, but at some point, doesn't that decision have to be voted on to make it actually permanent? Or BLM's famous for making rules that we all have to live by, but
well, they go through their process and then the rule is the rule. You can undo the rule, I suppose, but I don't know.
Once they go through the full public processes, they issue a record of decision. It's not law per se, but it carries the force of law in an actual process, and that's some of the problems with probably our Congress has delegated way too much functions. Well, another problem is can the government, like a friend of mine, I've had the opportunity to meet. I shouldn't say friend. I've met him, a brilliant man out of Utah. Would say is what in the Constitution grants the federal government the power to perpetuate and build a land empire out of a nation of states.
Exactly.
And that's part of the problem we have here is the federal government controls administratively a lot of that real estate or subsurface mineral estate. And now historically it hasn't been as huge of an issue. We've always had issues with federal government on certain, land stuff, but
but they see this as their own land, and that is, I think we need to slap the federal land out of everybody's mouth. It's public land. It belongs to the taxpayer, and they are supposed to be taking care of that land at the behest of the taxpayer and being paid by the taxpayer to do it. And instead, you're locked out. You can't have it. You can't use the resources. And now that we've set them aside and they could benefit all of us, nope, we're not doing that because we've decided some bird, some bush, some fish, some special group of people is more important than all of you. But you still get to pay the bill. We have to take a really quick break on that note. We'll play you something happy.
So you
don't feel angry all the time. We'd like to mix it up a little bit. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I ain't rich, but I damn sure want to be. Working like a dog all day ain't working for me. I wish I had a rich uncle that had kicked the bucket and I was sitting on a pile like Warren Buffett. I know everybody says money can't buy happiness,
It can buy me a boat. It can buy me a truck.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Did you know the non-native noxious weed we call marijuana is a thirsty plant? It uses up to 5 gallons of water a day in our climate. Most marijuana in California is chemically laden with pesticides, herbicides, miticides, growth hormones, and even adhesives like methacrylate used to boost pollen capture. Methacrylate? What the heck? Superglue? All this goes into the human body from unknowing users looking to get high. I call them the walking as yet undead. Remember, let's be safe out there.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions had an echo in so much space. And when you're out there without care, yeah, I was out of.
The answer to that is yes.
Yeah, Nathan, you're making me crazy. You're just telling me way too much.
If you know too much, they call you crazy. But if you know too much, it makes you crazy. So I don't know. I mean, I think instead of all roads lead to Rome, I think all roads lead to yes there. Oh, my God. Sometimes the more you look at this, though, the more out of control it gets. But and you look at this, kind of stuff all the time. Are you finding that it's the same thing, just different format? I mean, there's a lot of repetition to what it is they're doing and how they're doing it.
Yeah, there's a lot happening across the board at once, and you got to pick your battles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm in Montana. I work policy issues that are more broad sweeping that touch other states as well, but predominantly, obviously, I live in Montana, so I'm more oriented and focused on some things that are taking place on the ground here, like the coal. And the right-of-way rule applies to basically all the western states and federal lands in general.
Well, and it hits everybody. We're all paying for it, and when they start taking resources out of the system, that hits everybody's wallet. That's the thing. You know, sometimes this natural resource, not sometimes, a lot of the time, natural resource policy is not a particularly, captivating topic. I think sometimes think like, wow, why do they do so many shows on this stuff? It's because if you don't know this is happening, you're losing your liberty and by way of resources and your choices, and you don't even know it.
Yeah. Well, as I always say, everything comes from the ground. There's consequences to breaking away. Even our law comes from the ground. Our whole common law heritage. Well, there's actually two systems of law in history, and one is the law of the land. Notice law of the land. And the law of the city. One of those is common law, and the other one is Babylonian law. Those are the two competing influences. And by the way, our Reformed founding fathers in the 14, 15, and 1600s, the main battle was the common law courts versus the civil laws. And the common law courts had their jury by trial, and the civil law courts had their inquisition. And so it's the same battle then, same battle now, but everything comes from the ground, and that's one of the reasons I've made natural resources and private property rights one of the priorities in my life in that context and some of the work I do, because that has such a broad impact on, as you said, all the other freedoms and all the other things we enjoy in the world. depends on the freedom associated with developing and accessing and owning as individual people and private property, land, your business, the material products that you trade and barter on the market. It's essential, and we've been pretty severed from that as a people. And like I said at the beginning of the program, we need to. My question is, how did we get so removed from those founding principles? Because that's where we are.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other part of it is it's really complicated. They've made it just insanely complicated, where the processes and how you weigh in and the records of decision and just even the lingo is confusing and complicated. And so the average person who has a job and a family, and the more we press on them, the more they, the more time they work and try to make ends meet and all that, they don't have time to delve into all that. So a lot of the people who could support you on this probably don't, just because they don't really understand it.
Well, it's most Republicans and conservatives or people out there that care about liberty are focused on one branch of our government, and that's the legislative branch.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my work, I work with legislators and senators and representatives at the state and national level to some extent. But most of my work is focused on engaging the executive branch and equipping the record in such a way that when the judiciary comes into the picture through litigation to check the executive branch, my goal in the work I do is to equip the record and inform the record, because that's what goes to the judge's desk in those processes. But for the average person out there, absolutely, they know things are not good. They know things aren't going in a good direction. And most of our Republican outreach stuff is focused on elections and the legislative side as well, which that's important, and we need good people in the legislature. But I made a point. Here's a point I made to a friend talking about this the other day: is if you study back to common law in our history and heritage, the Parliament in England, clear up until the 15, 1600s, was a law-finding body, not a law-making body. And people historically forget that. We get our kids all ramped up in all these programs to learn the legislative process and bring your bill. But that's just as dangerous. We have everybody bringing their bill, but nobody looking at the original covenants and contracts and systems that are embedded in our original organic law, that all legislation is to be in pursuance thereof. So we have a whole bunch of unconstitutional legislation, which is part of the reason we have the bureaucratic issue that we've been discussing, because the legislature has illegitimately ceded its rulemaking power, lawmaking function, to the executive branch. And the judiciary, instead of checking the executive branch oftentimes on it, is helping the executive branch usurp the legislative prerogative.
Yeah, or deferring to them, even worse.
Exactly.
So when regular people, challenge them on it rather than looking, is there their ability to make those rules, is it legitimate? They look at it, well, if the agency's bringing it, they must have done their homework, so... I think that's where the Chevron decision from, two, three months ago came in and said, we're not going to, you guys can't defer to these guys all the time. I'll be curious to see how that comes out in the lower courts. I mean, that was a great Supreme Court decision, and hopefully some of the judges will take advantage of that. But, I'm not sure people understand that a lot of the problems are created in the executive branch. And so when they'll say, like, oh, well, it's the uniparty. Everything's the same. It doesn't matter who we have for a president. And I'm like, the executive branch is really the place where you've got a lot of problems.
Well, and, if we were functioning under the constitutional framework intended by our founders, that's why we have individual states, and because it's not just the legislative, executive, judicial. We have a subdivision of what James Madison called a compound republic in individual states with a whole other framework of legislative, judicial, and executive separated powers. And then we have another breakdown and subdivision in our local counties and municipalities. And the final aggregate of sovereign power and function is the individual landowner, the individual person and his possessions. It's the old, back to the English common law saying, a man's house is his castle. That's what we need to be reconnected to as a people. And that's where, when it comes to talking to people, like you said, the average person, what do they even do? Or how do they understand this stuff? I usually don't start and try to start with all the bureaucratic stuff and we need to do this here and there. Some people that work in those realms, I help in those areas. But my main passion, which is really the only reason I get involved in government the way I do, is reconnecting people to our heritage. Who we are as a people, where we come from, life, liberty, property, the cornerstones of a just society, which starts, by the way, in the home and the family. It's a sovereign jurisdiction. And I love the word jurisdiction because it comes from two Latin words. Juris is law and diction, dictate, to speak. So our responsibility is to be acquainted with our laws. And when I say laws, I'm not talking about the thousands of pages of bureaucratic rules. I'm talking about the Constitution, federal and state, wherever you live, the original documents, the Federalist Papers, and other crucial documents. Well, the Bible, there's another foundational one. The number one most cited book by our founders, the Scriptures, which, by the way, 1700s, 1500s, that was the whole freedom of religion was the free access to the word. So we've gotten to where we are by being severed from that heritage through the takeover of our institutions, teaching an alternative perspective that is the antithesis to our Judeo-Christian worldview, which is absolutely essential for all these things we've been talking about of limited government and private property and free markets. That's crucial. So my message in that context to the people that want to be more involved and know what's going on, your first step isn't finding the next BLM rule out there and reading the documents and trying to analyze and deal with that. It's
definitely not
connected to your heritage.
Well, you make a really great point. I think we tend to focus on bureaucratic rules and not the word law. I mean, our laws are what we need to get back to, and we just overlook so many things in our society today that are laws that we don't enforce, but we get all hung up on these rules that, you know, are really should be a side note to our judicial system, which is based in rule of law, and we're not doing that anymore, and we got to figure out a way to get back to that.
We were supposed to make this whole thing for the benefit of the people who lived in the country.
Yeah,
what a great idea! The rules were just keep orders.
Yeah,
so
now we're just making rules to control everybody within our borders. Which is
well, not everybody.
Well, that's
it's
true.
Mostly Nathan, you, me, and Robert, and probably Liam in there.
Yeah, we need to be controlled because we're out of control. But the elites definitely don't play by the same set of rules. So,
well, they don't, but the fact is they will be held accountable to the rules. It's like the old saying, show me your lawmaker and I'll show you your God.
Yeah,
and these people, their God is just like the gods of the ancient world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even Pharaoh's top, you know, magicians and soothsayers, as soon as Moses got through some of those final works of God and the palace there, even they were like, we can't do that. That's beyond us. This must really be God, you know. So these elites out there, these people that are, that's the thing, show me your law and I'll show you your God. And they don't follow the same rule, but they will be held accountable to that rule. And that day's coming, whether, in my opinion, part of our responsibility in the world, in a free society, is to check one another, even in our personal relationships, to hold one another accountable to basic principles of life, liberty, and property. To, you know, even with my little girls, I mean, the two things that I use as a foundation for teaching them, on them fighting over who gets the toy first or who gets to ride on Papa's dirt bike, is the two fundamental principles of common law. Keep your agreements, that's contract law, and don't encroach upon others. And that's tort law.
Mm-hmm.
All just law flows out of those two principles. Anything beyond that is arbitrary and capricious because it's man dictating to his fellow man how he is to function. And only God has that function and authority to do that. And even he, even God doesn't do that.
No, God said, go ahead and go make all the mistakes you want. We'll sort you out at the end. P.S. You should probably not make those mistakes.
Yeah. Well, it's self-government. So this boils back down to self-government. So what we have in the West, and I'll put this in historical terms, we have a reassertion of the royal prerogative. And the royal prerogative is a legal doctrine that existed, obviously, in the crown, under the crown in England. But the way I'm using it in the modern context is the royal prerogative is the umbrella term for the crown's non-statutory powers. So, like, back to these agencies making these rules, they're making them on, in some cases, non-statutory power. So that is, by definition, the assertion of the royal prerogative. And I'll remind your audience that one of the reasons our founding fathers ending up throwing off English, the English system, was for that very reason. From 1600 up until the 1750s, the colonies under their charter governments established very strong systems of local self-government. And the royal governors that were placed by the king in these colonies started to witness that firsthand and came directly in contact with that development of self-government. And rather than being like, man, those people are really industrious and they're really doing well, they're like, they regarded that as a, as an invasion of the royal prerogative. So that's where the issues in the colonies leading up to our Revolutionary War started, was they didn't like the self-governing context that the colonies were establishing under their charter governments, and they weren't opposing the English Constitution. All of that was established under English common law. But that's just a part of our history, that royal prerogative, and we put that to death in the Constitution of the United States of America. Once for all, but we see this same royal prerogative coming back and asserting itself. And what you saw the governors in the colonies doing to quell the self-government involved control of the press.
Yeah.
Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, all the things that we're into now.
Taxation.
Hold that list, and we will. I'm gonna lay some blame on the prerogative. Apparently, Bobby Brown is responsible for it, and so let's blame him. We'll come right back with our guest Nathan Deshmaker.
Just for you. This is Navy carrier pilot call sign 6 with a message to veterans. Local marijuana hucksters are offering free samples to veterans claiming that marijuana helps PTSD. These claims are not supported by legitimate medical studies, the VA or the FDA. Will you join me to protect our youth and our country from psychosis-inducing high-potency THC use? For the truth, please visit the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis at www.indiaalphasierraindiacharlie1.org. Thank you.
As close to heaven as Bobby Brown's ever going to get. Oh, wait. Sorry.
Nice.
But I digress. Oh, my God. I'm such a heretic. Save me, Nathan. So, you really bring up an excellent point, all joking aside. But we are going back to what we left, you know, over 200 years ago. We left that system because we didn't like it. And here we are again.
And what we're losing is the principle of self-government. And the problem is you need a virtuous people for self-government to consist. But just to finalize what I was saying before the break there on how the royal governors were coming against the colonies, you can see the spirit of how they dealt with the colonies developing these self-governing charters and functioning under them in the royal instructions that were sent at the time, which aimed at restraining the liberty of the press, and which thus denied the colonists the freedom of mind, and they also refused to allow them the writ of habeas corpus, which, according to English common law, deprived them of one of the great guards to personal liberty. And they also were against popular representation. This was taking place in the 1740s and 50s, 20-plus years before the Revolutionary War, that this was taking place to control the speech of the colonists through the control of the press, to control their mind and thinking thereby, and refusing them the writ of habeas corpus. And those were the instructions that were given to the governors in order to maintain the royal prerogative in early colonial America.
Well,
which is very interesting in what we're seeing today.
Yeah, exactly.
Very similar.
And are you in the circles that you travel? Do people see that, or do they just? I mean, I think everyone feels it, but I'm not sure they're putting those things together.
Well, so that's the other side of what I'm trying to do, and the work I'm doing is, I think everybody intuitively knows this. But so what I'm trying to do is there's nothing new under the sun. And, you know, I've made our history and our heritage a study of my desk. That's why I stress it so much, because everything else I do comes from those foundations. So that's at least in the sphere of influence that I'm involved in, I'm trying to resurrect this language. To give historical context to the issues. And that's the point of history, by the way. History isn't about listing the presidents in the right order and this happened at this date and this happened at that date. History is understanding the record of the past to know and understand the nature of man and how things function, and then to apply it to the day you're living in. That's the purpose of history, is application. So with what you just said, to the degree I'm able to, that's why I'm, you know, sharing this with you guys on the program here, because this is actually currently on my desk where I'm studying through some of this on the history of the colonies and how all this developed. And when you look around what's happening around us, the same efforts of government power to centralize control are being utilized. In some ways, where it's worse today, because we don't have a brute force tyranny like they did then, but it's what I call, or Tocqueville called, a democratic tyranny, and it places people under tyranny without the pains that came along with it physically with historical tyranny. So sadly, in that context, I think people are willing to go along with tyranny in government today because of the sophisticated systems we live within than they would have historically, because the results of that tyranny would have been more painful for the individual person than what we see today. They're pushing off the pain to consolidate the control, but the pain is coming, so we better, while we have time and have the ability to stand for something, stand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of it, a lot of this is really stemming too from the removal of God from our schools, from our government, from all of it, and we're lacking direction now.
Sure, because that void gets filled. So it's climate change. It's social policy.
All kinds of things.
I
just read a book by Jonathan Cahn called "The Return of the Gods," and it's about what's happening to our society once we've taken God out, and what's filling it, and what's filling it is exactly what you're talking about is what filled it in past history. Is coming back to visit us again, and we really need to get back on course, because our government was really based on a godly people, and we're not following that anymore, and some bad things are coming, and we really need to recognize that.
Exactly. You know, it makes me think about there's a proverb, or it might actually be even in the book of Isaiah, but it says, when the wicked come in like a flood, God raises up a standard against them.
Mm-hmm.
And my hope and what I try and strive for is to, and I think it's part of our responsibility as his ambassadors in the world, to hold up that standard. The only reason we are the beneficiaries of what we, you know, take for granted and the liberties we're discussing is because other men before us stood. They believed in something.
Mm-hmm.
And were willing to pay pretty high costs. You know, a lot of the work I do, for instance, in administrative work and policy, there's some things I contract on and get compensated, but I do a huge amount of the work I do because I care about the issues, and I'm concerned about raising that standard up in our culture and society. And the question is, if not you, who? And if not now, when?
Right.
So if God's placed me in my context to be able to do that with putting my time into trying to do some things and bring that standard up in those realms, then I'm going to try, at least in my capacity, to do that. And I'm kind of building a private membership association, which I'm kind of treating it like a missionary. but I'm not going to Zimbabwe. I'm going into the civil sphere to represent the property rights interests of individual people and their businesses, their land, their farming, mining, whatever area that is. And in that, I'm working on developing an educational component where we bridge the gap between theological realities and civic function and responsibility of man to perpetuate liberty in society. And I think I see more of that out there of some young folks and people and families really looking for the old paths and looking back to our fathers and, you know, how did they deal with these things, and what warnings did they give to us to not fall by the same example?
Right.
So
and
that's
I think
where
we're, yeah, we're ignoring a lot of those warnings now because it's exactly what they – what's happening is exactly what they said would happen if we didn't really follow, you know, what was put before us. And we're not. We're not following it, and we're going – we're splintering off, and you know, people aren't really together on so many things now. Everybody's just kind of going in a different direction. There's no unity. So, yeah, you're right. We need to kind of regroup a little bit and go back to, you know, what we originally stood for.
Exactly. So on that note, if you don't mind, I'm just going to – there's some – I don't know if you guys probably heard the song "Richmond North of Richmond."
Yes.
Yep.
The guy whose name is not
here recently.
Oliver Anthony. His name's Christopher something or other. But yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And apparently, he just denied an $8 million contract.
Yes, I read that too.
From a bunch of music executives. But I bring that up because I saw a clip of him at a farmer's market or fair or something where he read out of Proverbs, or not Proverbs, Psalm 37. I'm just going to read a couple of those verses because it's a really good choice of verses that he read. And in the context, it'll be a good summary to our discussion today, I think, as well. So Psalm 37, it says, "A little while and the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found. But the meek will inherit the land and enjoy great peace. The wicked plot against the righteous and gnash their teeth at them, but the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he knows their day is coming. The wicked draw the sword and bend the bow to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose ways are upright, but their swords will pierce their own hearts, and their bows will be broken. Better the little that the righteous have than the wealth of many wicked. For the power of the wicked will be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous. The days of the blameless are known to the Lord, and their inheritance will endure forever. In times of disaster they will not wither, in days of famine they will enjoy plenty. But the wicked will perish, the Lord's enemies will be like the beauty of the fields. They will vanish like smoke." So there's a Psalm 37, and you see a lot of that language in the Psalms of just, man, you see this wickedness, it seems like they're prevailing, and, you know, they grow old, and everything's, they never have any struggles, and then the psalmist says, "And then I came into the presence of the Lord, and I saw their end, and they have been placed in slippery places." So...
So you better.
So that's the consolation.
Yeah. Be careful which team you're playing on.
Yeah, it'll come around.
And you know the thing is, we have a lot of people in these agencies that want to do a good job, and don't. They're not down for the crazy stuff that their agencies are doing, and those guys are going to have to reach out to people who can help them, and they're going to have to be brave. There's going to have to be some bravery going forward.
Well, you know, you hear so much that, you know, politicians are all crooked. Well, who wants to run for office and try to do a good job when that's going to be the sentiment of you know, oh, he's just a politician. And I hear so many people that are running for office that say, "Well, I'm not a politician." Well, you know, you're going to have to
be in a minute. So yeah, I hope you do a good job.
Yeah, if you get elected, you're going to be a politician. But if good people don't run for these offices and try to make a change, change won't come.
No.
So we have to have good people run for office and not be afraid of what people are going to say, because that's the only way we're going to bring change.
We need them to get in there and hold a lot of these agencies accountable and hold the door open
exactly.
So that people who can make change, like Nathan, who do a lot of their homework, they can help us. Nathan, thank you so much for spending the afternoon with us, and we will speak to you again, no doubt. Very much appreciated. Any other information you have for us, please send it, and we will post it at
wethepeopleradio.us.
We got bills to pay. We got minds to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down. We can't hold back.
for good.